Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses in the government and commercial or corporate marketplace. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to nvbdc.org. We also want to thank Eisenhower Center. It's a brain injury recovery center, and in particular, it's after the impact program goes beyond awareness campaigns and state-of-the-art imaging to help veterans, first responders, and athletes. Learn more about EisenhowerCenter.com. They're located in Michigan and in Florida. And finally, we want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. Let me set this up. We're going to speak to Christian Broz, who is a deep thinker in the area of high-tech warfare and has a book out, The Kill Chain, Defending America in the Future of High-Tech Warfare. I think you'll find his thoughts provocative and interesting. And then the second interview will be with P.W. Singer. P.W. has written a number of books that really make you think about the future of war, not in a sci-fi sense, but in a reality sense. So I think you'll find both of these interviews very interesting in that regards. So let's get on to the interviews. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Christian Broz, who's a deep thinker in the areas of military and national security, and particularly with matters related to China. Chris, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, your background's interesting. Let's just set it up a little bit. I won't make you go through it all, but you got your bachelor's out of Kenyon College. You went on and got a master's at Johns Hopkins University in international economics, and then have spent a lot of time in U.S. government with the Department of State, where you were a policy and speechwriter for a couple of great secretaries of state, and you went on and were a national security advisor to Senator John McCain, and then you were also on the United States Senate Committee on Armed Services. That's a lot of great public service. Thank you.
I appreciate it, and I just consider myself fortunate that I had the opportunity to engage in public service for as long as I did, and to work with the great people that I did, from Colin Powell to Condoleezza Rice to John McCain. I have been very fortunate in having awesome bosses.
Well, those are two bright stars in the pantheon of bright stars in the the defense world. You're now chief strategy officer for Anduril Industries. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. So Anduril Industries is a technology startup that is focused on national defense. We're almost 3 years old, growing very rapidly. And, you know, we focus on building defense capabilities around technologies like artificial intelligence and autonomous systems, some of the things I read about in the book. And, you know, we are a defense company, so we're somewhat different than a lot of startups in the sense that, you know, our main customer, our main focus is the United States government, And specifically the national security agencies, the U.S. military, the Department of Defense. So, you know, you see a lot of, companies that are kind of running away from the U.S. military that don't want to work with the Department of Defense. You know, we're very much the opposite. You know, we want to help solve these national defense problems, and build exceptional technologies and capabilities for the U.S. military.
Well, and I think it's important. It's a, really a setup to the book and setups to some of the other talks we're going to have here this, is that you're really inherent in the DNA of this new startup is really a Silicon Valley tech firm approach, bridging that divide between the military maybe in Silicon Valley with its disruptive, innovative technologies. And I think that makes it kind of unique, doesn't it?
I think so. I mean, it certainly, I think, has given me a lot more knowledge and, just understanding and experience of these technologies, you know, kind of their capabilities, their limitations, certainly kind of the investment world in which, how money is flowing into companies and products like this. It has certainly made it a better book, in my opinion, than what it would have been, if I had written it while I was back in government. You know, I think I've learned a lot in the past year and a half, and a lot of that learning is reflected in the book.
Well, the book title is The Kill Chain, Defending America in the Future of High-Tech Warfare. Tell us what was the premise for setting out on this journey to write the book?
Yeah, so I, in the summer of 2018, I was at a conference where I was asked to write a paper about what emerging technology is going to mean for national defense and international security. So, I had a few thousand words where I had to think through, what are technologies like artificial intelligence and new space capabilities, hypersonics? What is that going to mean for how we build military forces, how we operate them, ways in which we should be thinking about that differently? That was the genesis of the book. And that's really the same question that I wrestled with over the past year in the writing of the book. I was focused in writing the book to try to communicate these ideas and subjects to a general audience. I didn't want to write it only for the experts and the specialists and the inside the Beltway crowd. I wanted to write it for informed Americans who are interested in these subjects and who need to understand, I think, the degree, I think, of problem that we find ourselves in. In terms of our national defense enterprise and the ways in which we need to think about changing. As far as the kill chain goes as an organizing concept, many of your listeners are going to be familiar with this. I think, it's the phrase that everybody in the military or the Department of Defense understands, that, most people outside of that world have never heard of. And it's just very simply the process by which militaries understand what is happening in an operational environment. How they make decisions about things they want to do, and then how they take actions. And to me, that is the organizing concept, because that is actually what our military is seeking to do when it's competing with other forces in battle spaces or operational environments. We build technology not for its own sake, not to sort of rely upon the tools that we've always had to just make them incrementally better. We build technology and sort of capabilities to enable us to close the kill chain faster in military parlance, to make, to understand what's happening better and at scale, to make better decisions faster than our adversaries, and to take more relevant actions, more time-sensitive actions, faster than our competitors can. And technology is not going to be the magic wand that saves us. It's going to be an enabling capability that allows us to solve these problems differently. And that's really the focus that I'm trying to bring to the book and sort of putting things into that perspective.
And you mentioned it, why don't you expand on it a little bit. Today we have more sensors and data gathering than ever before. I can only imagine projecting out that you view this as even more information to process. And the idea that artificial intelligence or AI has to come into play here for the Department of Defense and those who are at the pointy end of the spear. Tell us how you see that evolving.
So I think the way that it's going to evolve is going to start directly where you mentioned, which is, our military right now is drowning in information. We have very exquisite sensors that are deployed, you know, all over the world, outer space, many other domains that are just hoovering up, gathering vast quantities of information, looking for the proverbial signal within the noise or the needle within the haystack. But that job of discovery, of sort of sense making, largely falls to human beings. And we're talking tens of thousands of human beings in our military whose job it is to figure out, you know, where is the signal inside of the noise? I think these technologies allow us right now to begin putting sort of intelligent machines or intelligent processes, kind of machine learning enabled technologies, into a position where they can perform more effectively than human beings. But that isn't to displace the human operator. It's to better inform the human operator so that that individual can focus his or her cognitive space on more important problems, higher value problems, operational problem solving, ethical problem solving, the kinds of things that people join the military to do and that we need human beings in the military to do, but they need to be supported in making sense of this vast ocean of information by more and more capable machines or programs or algorithms that can enable them to very quickly take a vast data set and boil it down to a smaller set of indicators that they can then go interrogate to determine what are the things that they're looking for. So it's a process of accelerating the process of sense making, which I think just at a foundational level is something that we can be doing right now, right? This is not science fiction. This is here now. It is available now. And I think the Department of Defense is largely behind the curve in this regard. But I think they're actively trying to catch up.
And I think that's important for folks to realize, and many veteran radio listeners have, you know, they've been out of the service for a long time, would not even recognize the amount of sensors and information that have to be processed. But you, as you say, this is no longer science fiction. There are things going on today that, you know, 20 years ago might have looked like science fiction.
Right.
What are the top three or four recommendations that you're sort of making that says, hey, you're behind the curve. These are the things you need to be doing.
So, you know, just starting right where we left off from the standpoint of making sense of massive amounts of information, you know, kind of boiling vast data sets down to, you know, more informed indicators that human beings can look at so that rather than having to look at, you know, 15,000 pieces of straw to find one needle, you know, you can boil that down to, you know, a few dozen because, you know, machine programs, well-trained algorithms can go through large quantities of imagery or, you know, kind of auditory sensor information and pattern match with, you know, what are the images that have people in them or what are the images that have vehicles or military targets in them? Again, giving the human operator more cognitive space to focus less on those kinds of very technical, very repetitive, somewhat menial tasks so that they can focus on higher value tasks supported by these machines and systems. At a basic level, that is going to be something that we can do right now. But again, it's what's really at play here is, you know, human beings delegating tasks to subordinates. And rather than delegating them to human subordinates, in this case, they're delegating them to machine subordinates. It's a process that we've been playing out for a very long period of time, and I think these technologies will only continue that. And as those technologies and machines become more capable, capable of doing more autonomously under human direction and human control, they will be, you know, human operators will be able to delegate more tasks to them. So it's not just making sense of information, it's going to be, you know, navigating the environment, collaborating to contextualize information, moving information from one place or, you know, one sensor to one shooter without a human being having to physically direct that activity to happen. You know, getting the human operator to focus on what am I trying to do? What are the effects I'm trying to create without having to get into all of the technical and repetitive details of the machinery that makes that happen. Again, this is by no means to say that we're going to eliminate the fog of war, that we're going to eliminate uncertainty from the conduct of war, that human beings are going to become irrelevant in the conduct of war. Quite the opposite. The way I look at this and the way I talk about it in the book is these technologies are an opportunity to get human beings doing the things that they actually need to be doing in these military environments, on these military problems, doing it better, doing it in a more informed way, a more effective way than they have been to date.
We're talking to Christian Brose, who's the author of The Kill Chain, Defending America and the Future of High-Tech Warfare. And his work and this book in particular was brought to my attention in a recent article talking about military primacy over China. Do we have it or do we not? And I think we probably all recognize that maybe our number, if not number one, and there's number one or two adversary in this cyber world is China in a lot of different ways. Talk to us a little bit about your concern on where this race to technology is going and where we are relative to the other world's, to use an old term, superpower, China.
Yeah, so for me in the book, kind of the pacing challenge here is very much China and the Chinese Communist Party. Largely that at sort of a strategic level is because, you know, what I think we have in China is a competitor unlike anything the United States has dealt with since probably the 19th century. You know, we talk about the Cold War as a great power competition, and that's true enough. But, you know, at the peak of its power, the Soviet Union was only 40% of U.S. GDP. It was largely isolated from the international economy and trading system. You know, it didn't have a vibrant and robust base of domestic technological development. China is on path in the next decade to equal our GDP. It is completely integrated or largely integrated into the global economy and the trading system. And even though they have stolen a lot of intellectual property from the United States and others, you know, they are beginning to build world-leading companies, you know, kind of advanced technological capabilities that are organic to China. And I think they see this as a competition. They are moving with a sense of urgency to displace us as a world power, harnessing these emerging technologies to leap ahead. Their words, the United States and sort of the position of dominance that we have, you know, kind of enjoyed for a very long period of time. And I think, you know, this is a broad challenge that cuts across, you know, the economy, diplomacy, you know, questions of ethics and values. But in the military dimension, you know, the concern that I write about in the book is, you know, really since the early 1990s, China's military modernization has been focused on playing a different game than the United States. They're not trying to play the same game as us. They're playing a disruptive game. They are focused on calling into question and undermining all of the assumptions on which America and the U.S. military project power abroad. They have systematically built up over 25 or more years a set of advanced capabilities, an arsenal of advanced weapons that are focused on, you know, identifying the sources of American military power in the Asia-Pacific region and undermining them and calling them into question. So whether it's our forward bases in places like Japan or Guam, whether it's the strike aircraft that would be relevant, obviously, in a conflict, whether it's the carrier and the carrier battle group that would accompany it, identifying these sources, you know, to say nothing of the vast kind of command and control architecture, information and communications architectures that we rely upon as a U.S. military to operate effectively. China has sought through a doctrine that they call systems destruction warfare to systematically break those battle networks apart, target those sources of American strength, and push the United States military farther and farther away, deny us access to the region, make it more and more difficult for us to carry out the kinds of military operations, achieve the kinds of policy objectives that we've said for a very long period of time are in the U.S. national security interest.
And this attack, Christian, is both sort of systems and social. The cyber warfare allows them to work on challenging the systems needed to use all these sophisticated sensors and machines and all that and try to break those down. But they also seem to be really focused on sort of social chaos or disruption to have those Asian Pacific countries say, hey, we don't want your base here anymore. You can't bring those craft, the Navy craft into here anymore. Talk to us a little bit about how this is a multi-front game that they're playing.
Yeah, it's a great question because, you know, the book that I focused on was very much focused on sort of the military dimension of this problem in sort of a hard power sense. But, you know, I go out of my way to be very clear that there are a lot of other kind of components to this challenge. And the ones that you're mentioning are, you know, I would argue just as relevant, in some cases more relevant than the ones that I'm even writing about. So with regard to activities focused at the United States domestically, you know, there's a very long history, you know, that we can point to of, yes, cyber-related espionage, economic espionage, intellectual property theft, you know, identifying ways in which, you know, Chinese investment can sort of put emerging technologies or, you know, startup companies in a position where their intellectual property is at risk and something that can then be kind of taken back into China and sort of developed in their system, both for civilian and military purposes. This has been ongoing for a very long period of time. And then I think in a regional sense, a very active campaign, exactly as you suggested, of trying to call into question U.S. national security commitments to core treaty allies, making it harder and harder for those countries to feel like they have the type of partner, the type of commitment from the United States that they would want. You know, you see this playing out with the Philippines now, where I think many assumptions of how, you know, what kind of access the U.S. military might have are being called into question or eroded by, you know, Chinese influence, Chinese money in many senses, that are actively focused on making it harder for the United States to maintain our allies, our commitments, and ultimately the types of relationships that we have long maintained in that region as sources of strength for, you know, not just our military operations, but our economy, our economic interests, you know, sort of the health and vibrancy of the United States way of life.
Do you see China focusing some of that activity not only in their sphere of influence, which over in the Pacific or the South China Sea, hard for me to say, but also domestically here in the United States? So we've got a lot of stuff going on in 2020, and you do begin to wonder on a social basis how much of that might be involved with outside forces seeing opportunities.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, you look at statements that have come out of the U.S. government from senior leaders in the U.S. government, you know, not just the current administration, but former administrations. There is a rising concern of Chinese influence in the United States, in our domestic kind of political environment, certainly with respect to social media, sort of new information platforms. You know, we've obviously seen this in spades with Russia and the active measures that Russia has taken to effectively weaponize our social media and sort of our openness, sort of transparency and movement of information. That is something that, you know, is very much playing out along the lines of a conscious strategy on the part of the Russians. And I think there's a growing concern that, you know, the Chinese have learned a lot by watching Russian activities in recent years. And this may be a series of activities that they're starting to get more involved in themselves.
As you've transitioned over the last year or so on this book, from starting out as a white paper and now writing The Kill Chain, Defending America and the Future of High-Tech Warfare, Christian Bros, do you see that the policymakers in Washington, D.C. are alerted to these problems that you're talking about, or still distracted by other things and not focusing on the issues that you've raised?
I think in the course of my time, I've definitely watched the sort of policymaking community, you know, U.S. government leaders become more and more focused on the types of challenges that we're talking about with China in particular, but sort of kind of the reemergence of great power competition more broadly. That is something that I think is moving, you know, in a sort of demonstrably better direction as far as the attention that policymakers are giving it, the sense of urgency that they feel to make changes domestically to ensure that we don't find ourselves, you know, in a world where we have become surpassed. That is happening. It's certainly something that in my time with Senator McCain and my work in the Senate, you know, we tried very, very deliberately to put people's attention on these problems, kind of lift them out of their day-to-day concerns and say, look, we've got to put things in perspective here as far as, you know, what the real challenges facing the nation are. I think the challenge is kind of what you're alluding to is that, you know, it's the urgent always crowds out the important in a lot of these instances. You know, you've got all of the day-to-day political cut and thrust. You've got a lot of problems, you know, domestically in the country right now that take up a lot of people's time and attention as they should. But we can't afford to lose sight, I think, of this broader, you know, kind of long-term strategic challenge that we have that's playing out right now, very much, I think, between the United States and China. We just welcome the opportunity to talk about the ideas.
Well, thanks for taking some time today to talk to Veteran Radio listeners and to help us look out a little farther and get some feel for what's happening technology-wise and who we should be keeping an eye on. We really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. And I know a lot of the folks who are listening are veterans and have served. And let me just, you know, thank all of them who are listening, who have served, for their service. Something that means a lot, and I really appreciate that.
Stick around after the break to hear from P.W. Singer, a national security futurist. We want to thank our Ann Arbor VSOs for their support of Veterans Radio. Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles, Chapter 310. The American Legion, Post 46. And VFW Graf O'Hara Post 423. Again, all in Ann Arbor, all long-term supporters of Veterans Radio. So again, come back after the break. You're going to find this a very interesting interview.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Private First Class Emery Bennett, although wounded, continue to defend his position. Details after this. At approximately 2 a.m., two enemy battalions swarmed up the ridgeline in a ferocious banzai charge in an attempt to dislodge Bennett's company from its defensive positions. Meeting the challenge, the defenders delivered destructive retaliation, but the enemy pressed the assault with fanatical determination and the perimeter was imperiled. Fully aware of the odds against him, Bennett unhesitatingly left his foxhole, moved through withering fire, stood within full view of the enemy, and employing his automatic rifle, poured crippling fire into the ranks of the onrushing assailants, inflicting numerous casualties. Although wounded, Bennett gallantly maintained his one-man defense, and the attack was momentarily halted. During this lull in battle, the company regrouped for a counterattack, but the numerically superior foe soon infiltrated the position. Upon orders to move back, Bennett voluntarily remained to provide covering fire for the withdrawing elements, and defying the enemy, continued to sweep the charging foe with devastating fire until mortally wounded. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Welcome back to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone, your officer of the deck today. We're going to hear from P.W. Singer, a national security futurist. But we want to again thank our major sponsors, NVBDC.org, National Business Development Council, that certifies veteran-owned businesses and helps them get a leg up in corporate and government contracting, and Legal Help for Veterans, veterans' disability law firm, helping them get their VA benefits all across the country. You can reach them at LegalHelpForVeterans.com or 800-693-4800. And now, on to our interview. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today P.W. Singer, a strategist at New America, which is a Washington, D.C. think tank. And we're here to talk about some of his books. He's got a new one coming out this month, and sort of the future of war. P.W., welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, thanks very much for having me on.
Well, you have really focused your career as a, and you've been called actually, the premier futurist in the national security environment. That's kind of a mouthful. Explain to our veteran radio listeners sort of where your focus has been.
So I wear a couple of hats. I write research and write books about key trends shaping today and tomorrow. And then I also do consulting and advisory for organizations like the U.S. military and also the intelligence community, as well as tech firms and the like. So, you know, sometimes people hear the word futurist and they think, you know, pie in the sky and the like. For me, how I help the organizations is essentially it starts with research. You know, what are real world trends, technologies? Sometimes it might be something that's playing out right now. Sometimes it actually might be pulling from the past. What's a similar situation that we faced in history and what are lessons that we can pull from that? And so, yeah, it's been fantastic. A lot of fun and hopefully a great way to make a difference and help us avoid mistakes that set us down the wrong pathway.
Well, and it, what caught my eye was an article talking about how the COVID-19 situation had sort of sped up certain trends that had been seen, and then how that might also impact future wars, future conflict resolutions. You've written a lot of books in the that end up falling onto the professional military reading list, including Corporate Warriors, The Rise of the Privatized Military Industry, Children at War, Wired for War, cybersecurity and cyber war, all things which folks thinking about conflict should be looking at as these trends and technologies kind of smash into each other. You've also now begun writing sort of what's been described as a new type of novel, melding the format of a techno thriller to communicate nonfiction research. You first wrote Ghost Fleet, a novel of the next world war, and you have coming out a novel called Burn-In, a novel of the real robotic revolution. Tell us a little bit about your nonfiction work, and then we'll turn to the fiction techno thriller work.
Sure. So the line that's cut through the different books that I've done has been exploring forces of change that are changing the national security environment, reshaping the experience of war, even the identity of who goes to war. And the research that I do comes at it in a way that mixes everything from, you know, gathering what's written out there to doing interviews of the real world people who are living it. The first of these books was Corporate Warriors. It's funny to go back in time, but it was the very first book to look at the rise of what we call the private military industry. The companies that are, you know, familiar to people now, like Blackwater or Halliburton KBR, where essentially you saw businesses not just selling the goods of war, selling weapons, but selling the service side of war, doing jobs that we would have previously had inside the military. And the book explored what was going on, and also some of the big issues and dilemmas that were going to come out of that, which, of course, we did see play out of that in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. Then it was a book looking at the rise of warlord groups and how we weren't seeing wars so much as between people wearing uniforms, and that you even had new actors like child soldiers coming into it. Then a book called Wired for War that explored how out in Iraq and Afghanistan, we had these technologies from science fiction, robots actually starting to be used, not just out in the battlefield, but it was also, you know, for people on the Air Force side. You had someone sitting at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada flying a plane that was over Afghanistan. This is a really big deal, really big change. It affected everything from tactics and doctrine to the laws of war to just the individual experience of what it was like to go to war, what it was like to command a unit operating this way. And then more recently, the books on the nonfiction side have jumped into the digital realm. So one was an explainer of cybersecurity and cyber war. It was literally called Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. And it hits that idea of what everyone needs to know. Not everyone needs to know how to be a hacker, but, you know, whether you are a soldier, whether you are a business leader, whether you're a grandparent, you now got to know some of the basics of cybersecurity to protect yourself, your networks, your family, et cetera. And then the last one on the nonfiction side was called Like War. And it explored how social media, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, was actually becoming a little bit like a battlefield. And so what we did is we looked at how groups that range from ISIS to Russian military intelligence to Donald Trump to the pop star Taylor Swift to companies to street gangs in Chicago, teenagers, how all of these different groups were using social media and what the effect that it was having, not just on the online world, but what was the effect all this having on our real world, be it our elections, be it what you buy in the store. We're seeing it right now. Pandemic of coronavirus has been accompanied by what they call the infodemic, which is this just wave of disinformation and misinformation online that's the public health professionals actually say it's cost many lives. And so that's, you can see sort of, again, the thread going through all of this work is basically trying to help us understand the forces of change, but to do it in a manner that's not wonky, to capture the real world stories and experiences of people. And in many ways, that kind of led to the fiction side for me.
Before we jump into that, those books, I want to really point this out to our veteran radio listeners. The reason we asked P.W. Singer to come on and talk is we've often talked to military writers who are looking backwards, explaining Vietnam, explaining Korea, World War One, Afghanistan, Iraq, what we did and why we did it. This is a really interesting set of work, and really you have to look at his work as a whole set of looking forward how technology and trends may impact military conflicts going forward. So we could spend days. I told PW at the start of this, my biggest problem is going to be keeping this to the 25-minute format that we try to use. But I really want to recommend to folks that they go out and look at these books and maybe pick up one or two of them to get that forward-looking view that we often don't see, and certainly we don't get it out of the general public, general media that the public gets. And you found another way to sort of take some of these things and maybe make it a little easier to read or a little less intimidating to people by moving into a novel format. Tell us about those books.
So maybe the starting point for it is the way that you framed it really kindly of, you know, sort of making it easier but more fun. So the last two books I've done have been this combination of novel and nonfiction. So for the parents and grandparents out there, it's a little bit like sneaking fruit and veggies into the morning smoothie, except in this case it's you entertainment, but you also get the good stuff of walking away from it a little bit more informed. And the origin of this was an experience. I work with a co-author on it, a guy named August Cole, who was the defense beat reporter for Wall Street Journal for many years. Both of us sort of come out of this world of working with the military and the like. And yet we teamed up to write a novel, and the novel was called Ghost Fleet. And it looked at what a war between the U.S. and China might be like. Now, we wrote it with the intent of recreating that experience that we had had as readers, enjoying early Tom Clancy. The two of us didn't know each other, growing up, but both of us had these stories of reading, you know, Red Storm Rising. For me, it was, the back of my mom's station wagon on the way to a summer beach vacation, you know, back before we even had to wear, seatbelts. And, you know, so we wanted to recreate for people that experience. But what happened is because it was this, you know, it was a fun read, but also it mixed, you know, real world information. We had this rule that everything in it had to be drawn from the real world. It ended up striking a chord within the military. You know, as you mentioned, it made all the military reading lists. We were actually invited to brief the real world lessons of it to over 75 different organizations, units, and bases. You know, so everything from the tank, which is, you know, the Joint Chiefs of Staff conference room inside the Pentagon, to units like 82nd Airborne, JSOC, the team that got bin Laden, you name it. The Navy even named a $3.6 billion program Ghost Fleet. They didn't give us any money for it, but it was, you know, really kind of them. But the point is, we were like, it struck us that no one ever said, wow, I read this really great PowerPoint. You ought to read it too by the pool. Or no one ever said, you know, man, this was such a good academic paper. It kept me up late at night. I just wanted to read on to the next chapter. But they do say that about a novel. And so that we jumped on that from that experience of like, hold it, the novel could have impact on the real world. You know, people could have fun, but they could also learn from it. And that's what we've hopefully pulled off with this new book that's out on May 26th called Burn-In. And Burn-In, the name of it is taken from the idea of in technology, when you push something to the breaking point to learn from it. So like, you know, when you take a new watch underwater and try and figure out, okay, how deep can it go? So Burn-In is a novel. It's a techno thriller. It follows a veteran, linked to, you know, your audience, who's joined the FBI and is on the hunt for a terrorist through the streets of Washington, D.C.
Now, I want to stop here because I know a lot of my veteran radio listeners are going, as we talk to P.W. Singer, oh, I don't like science fiction. This isn't science fiction, is it?
It's you know, one, I'd put it a little more in the frame of techno thriller. So, you know, there's a, maybe put it this way. It's not science fiction in the frame of, it's not set hundreds of years away. It's not set on another planet. It's not set, there's no, you know, magic technology. And this is the key, is that it's drawn from the real world. So,
and that was the key as I read Burn-In and said, okay, this isn't science fiction. I'm not a big science fiction guy. Every time I talk to a science fiction author, I tell them, you're going to have to convince me to read this. But what's interesting here is the technology that you're talking about and the trends you're talking about were all sort of relatable. They were all things like, oh yeah, I've heard a little something about that. And it seemed like every other page had something that fit that description of coming technology or trend. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason for that is that baked into the story are actually over 300 explanations and predictions, but with an end note to show you, hey, this is from the real world. So that's kind of your nonfiction side of it. Now, so the point is, you know, for some readers, you know, it's like the taste of the, of, you know, oh, I like the taste of milkshakes. So it's, you don't have to go to the sources. You can just read it. You can just enjoy it. For other people, they might go, hold it. Is that real? And then they can go to, hey, actually, here's the reference that shows that it's real. Or, and it might be because they want to learn more. It might be just to validate that it's real. For me, it actually makes the fiction more compelling because, it takes that kind of, you know, whatever the nightmare scenario and the fact that, hey, it really could happen, makes it hit you a little bit more. And so the idea is that through the book, you get entertained, but you also learn about all of these different things out there that are starting to shape the world around us, whether it's, hey, this, you know, AI used to be something in science fiction. It's now in the real world. It's affecting everything from the world of war to how my bank works, to the toys that my kids or grandkids use. Or it might be a certain kind of cyber attack that plays out, again, drawn from the real world. Or maybe it's a certain kind of dilemma or issue in politics that we're seeing more of, issues that relate to division and distrust. And so, again, the idea of it is that you sort of get both sides. And that's why one of the things that's been, you know, so cool about the experience is, while you and I are talking, the book is about 5 days to coming out. So it's not officially come out, but, you know, you've gotten an early read to it. Some of the other groups have gotten an early read to it. And what's been so funny to me, and just awesome is, we've gotten these really kind reviews from two wildly different groups. One is from, you know, people, you know, kind of on the, you would describe them as like on the real world side. So the former or current heads of the U.S. Marine Corps, the U.S. Navy, Cyber Command, to the CIA, NATO, UCOM, et cetera. So kind of, you know, people who deal with real world serious issues. And then at the other side, we've gotten this really kind phrase from, the creator of, the TV show Lost, Watchmen, the new Star Trek movie. So, you know, for some people, it's going to be like, you know, okay, if, you know, this person, this general in the Marine Corps says it's useful, maybe that's, maybe I ought to pay attention. For other people, it's going to be, oh man, I like the new Star Trek movies. I'm going to check that out. But to me, what's so funny about it is like, these are groups that would never normally meet. It's almost like, you know, two people walking into a bar. But the fact that they're both finding something out of it hits this idea that, fiction can be useful.
Oh, it's a great read. I can,
oh, thank you.
I think I can recommend it. I think you referred to this as sort of a beach read. It's definitely a summer read that you'll enjoy. I'm glad that,
if I can interrupt you there, the one for a lot of us right now, you know, we're not going to be able to go to the beach.
Right. So
related to the pandemic, I will plot spoil a little bit. There is nothing in it related to about a pandemic or a disease. So you can get a nice escapist read. I'll plot spoil that way.
Perfect. And I'm sure your publisher, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, MH Books, is thrilled that it's still going to come out, notwithstanding a lot of publications, books have been pushed because of the pandemic. But I want to take a few minutes that we have left here and turn to, because you've written on China and AI and the U.S. military as a national security futurist. What do you worry about in that realm? Let's, P.W. Singer, take a few minutes to educate our veteran radio listeners.
Sure. So, and that was actually what drove me on the writing of the prior book, Ghost Fleet. We started out on the research for it back in 2013. And if you remember back then, the focus of, you know, both on the U.S. military side, our national defense strategy, the training and doctrine, was all about insurgency, terrorism, et cetera. And the same thing was actually playing out in the fiction realm. You know, even the Tom Clancy books were all about terrorism. And yet what you could see, you know, looking at trends is the rise of a new great power competitor and I would argue a different kind of competitor in the Soviet Union back during the Cold War. So it's not just a military competitor, but China differs in that it's also an economic competitor as well as a technology competitor. You know, you think about the Soviet Union, other than in the early period of the space race and rocketry, it wasn't really a technology competitor to us. You know, whether it was on the military side, they never developed, you know, stealth weapons to on the civilian side. They never even make a good car, let alone a good personal computer versus China's, you know, not just developing all this, but manufacturing a lot of these systems. So China's definitively a competitor. But it's also one in which a situation we've never seen before, where we're sort of wrapped up within each other's economies, whether it's manufacturing of the chips that go into our weapon systems, to the discussion now around some people are saying like, let's just ban everything from China. We're mad at them about coronavirus, and there's a lot to be mad about. But you know, there's also the cold hard reality that China is a hub for the manufacture of a pretty big percentage of medical equipment and even medicine itself. So you've got this really complex problem that presents you, and so I think that issue is going to shape the future of not just defense strategy, but overall kind of U.S. political strategy moving forward. But we've got to do it in a eyes wide open way. You can't think you're going to solve it in some simple, easy issue. You know, oh, we'll just ban all trade from China. Sorry, that it just doesn't work that way. Maybe you want to, but, you know, OK, in the real world, you have to implement this stuff. So what are you actually going to implement to do this? What are you going to do to make sure that you are bringing the key partners to make sure that you can pull it off? So you can't have a go it alone strategy against China. You've got to have your partners from NATO. You've got to have your partners in the Pacific, the Australias, the Japans, the South Koreas. You can't be alienating them. You got to have them on board if you want to win in this kind of competition. You've got to also pay attention to what's playing out in China. So you had this really strange disconnect where we were observing the outbreak of coronavirus in China. We were observing all the things that their government was doing to downplay it, to censor the news, to not handle it well. And yet you had government leaders in the administration at the time, you know, go back to January, February, they were praising China for what they were doing. So, you know, it's again, we got to do this in a way that's smart if we want to win at a competition that's going to shape the next generation.
Well, and you read somewhere, you were also talking about how it's interesting that the PLA, the Chinese army, has been sort of not around for many of this developing story over the last 60 days, and what's that mean? And you really do have to take a universal view of this and not just get stuck on one issue, don't you?
Exactly. And it also is a great illustration of, you know, for your listeners who, you know, come out of the military intelligence side, but, you know, everybody on the military is also a consumer of that, is that one of the big sea changes in the last generation is about how much information is available out in the open, that it's not just the way it was in the past of, you know, signals intelligence, you know, a cracker radio network or a secret spy satellite. There's a lot of stuff out there in the open. They call it open source intelligence. And what we could see in January period is a couple of things that were out in the open. We knew the pandemic was breaking out. We also knew that the Chinese government was downplaying and lying about it. And third, we also knew that the Chinese military was not handling it well. They weren't doing the kind of deployments that you usually see in a pandemic. All of this was out in the open. And, I wrote about it for outlets like The Atlantic and Defense One, but I was not the only one. There was lots of writing on this. And it's kind of unfortunate because it's horribly unfortunate because this information was out in the open. The governments all around looked at that information. Again, the Australias, the South Koreas, the Japans, the Germanys, and the US, and they all digested it different ways. The South Koreas, the Australias, the Taiwans, the Germanys looked at that and said, okay, we've got this information. We need to prepare. We need to put into place the kind of things to protect our population. And the result of that is that they've not experienced, unfortunately, the outbreak of coronavirus in the same way. You look at the death toll in some of these nations, and it's just orders of magnitude lower than it is here in the U.S. Let's take an example of Australia. Australia has 100 deaths from coronavirus. 100, not 100,000, 100. Now, they're about one-fifth the size of the U.S., but, you know, put on your math hat and, you know, multiply 100 times 5, and it shows you a completely different pathway that we could have followed, even though we had the same information. So kind of what I'm getting at is China, massive things to blame for, downplaying the outbreak, trying to censor it, not handling it really well. Yes. But that doesn't mean that that's the only part of the story that's out there. And so, again, it points to how we have to look, we have to act like adults here. We have to use.
Well, as you point out, it's all, yeah, as you point out, there's that information's there. It's how you interpret it and how you extrapolate from it. And that's
and how you make hard decisions using that kind of information. You know, again, it can be either you say, well, I don't like that information, so I'm going to say, you know, I don't believe it, or, you know what, maybe I don't like that information, so, you know what, I don't like those facts. I'm going to go out and get my own facts. Right? Facts don't work that way.
Well, yeah, we're back to alternative facts, right?
So, you know, the point of all this is that, again, as we look forward, you know, these are the decisions were made, and these are the cards that have been dealt. We got to learn from that. We've got to make sure that we're not repeating the same kind of mistakes. And in particular, we have to, make mature and sometimes very hard decisions.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with P.W. Singer, National Security Futurist. Look for us on veteransradio.net. This is Jim Fossone. Dale will be back next week. And until then, you are dismissed.